From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the June 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Dire Straits. In May 1945, the Royal Navy fought its last surface action against the Japanese fleet, sinking the cruiser Haguro in the Malacca Strait off the coast of Malaya. The successful location of the enemy ship was the result of signals intelligence. It was also a product of the sophisticated network built up by Britain, the USA and Australia after 1943 to intercept, decipher and distribute intelligence around the Pacific and Indian Oceans. In this It Happened Here episode, we're joined by Bletchley Park's research historian Dr. David Kenyon to discuss the role of the Codebreakers in this milestone on the road to ultimate victory over Japan in 1945. This episode features veteran Edward Simpson from our oral history archive. Our thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson and Owen Mugan for voicing our historical documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, tell us, how had codebreaking against the Japanese evolved by 1945?
We've talked in the podcast before about codebreaking in the early part of the war against the Japanese in 1942 with the invasion of Singapore and then the Battle of Midway, which is a turning point in the war. From that point on, the codebreaking relationship between the UK and the USA evolves towards getting ever better, but it's quite a bumpy road to get there. And there are a series of different agreements. They sort of get together and fall out, get together and fall out several times. The most significant agreement that we've talked about previously is a thing called the Brewster Agreement, the Britain-USA agreement that was signed in 1943. And that's important from the point of view of Bletchley Park because it results in the first big batch of Americans coming. Americans have come in sort of ones and twos prior to 1943, but after that you get a big batch of Americans who come and join all the various Enigma sections. They work in Hut 3 and Hut 6 and elsewhere. That happens partly because there's basically a division made and they say, right, the UK and Bletchley Park will deal with the Germans and the European war and the US code-breaking agencies, because they have two, they have an army one and a navy one. They'll deal with the Japanese war. It seems very straightforward. You just say Americans, Japanese, Britons, Germany and Italy. Problem with that is that Britain is also still fighting the war in Burma and the Far East generally. So they still want to be able to do codebreaking. And conversations or arguments go on into late 1944 about how this is actually going to be done. You think it would be easy for the British to say, let's just let the Americans get on with it and then we can concentrate on Enigma and it's not a problem. But one of the things that all codebreaking agencies have always done is if you're working on a particular type of code, you don't want to stop because continuity of expertise and everything else is really important. And so for a sort of long-term, almost theoretical reason, they want to keep their hand in with Japanese work. So they're saying, we still want to do Japanese codebreaking, even though it's mainly an American responsibility. And they end up with a system where the Americans send undeciphered messages that they've intercepted in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. They send them to Bletchley Park and to Colombo, the Bletchley Park outpost in Sri Lanka, where they can be broken there. But the problem with this is it takes ages. The undersea cable from the USA to Britain is very busy, so old Japanese messages aren't a big priority. Or they send them by bag in an aeroplane, which is even slower.
In an aeroplane.
Well, the term is a bag, like a diplomatic bag.
We use the term.
It was literally a mail sack with a string around the top. The problem with this is it's great for Bletchley Park to be able to maintain its skill set for breaking Japanese codes, but it doesn't really help the Royal Navy actually at sea in the Indian Ocean because they need much more up-to-date information. And it's only in 1944 when they really get their act together. Interestingly, somebody we've talked about quite a lot, Harry Hinsley, who is one of the leading codebreakers in naval section here at Bletchley Park, he goes to Washington, D.C. to talk to the US Navy's Op 20G, which is their naval codebreaking section. Hinsley actually suggested that if he went to Washington as, quote, a low-level bloke, he might get further than if one of the senior bosses went. He sort of thought he'd be less intimidating to the Americans. And he's right, because he manages to negotiate another agreement, which is finally signed in January 1944. the Americans agree to share, although they do a lot of the code breaking, they agree to share the intelligence in a much faster way with the Royal Navy in the Indian Ocean. And they establish this thing called the Brusa Circuit. The problem you have is that the Pacific Ocean covers, you know, nearly half the surface of the Earth. It's an enormous bit of sea.
It's rather large, yeah.
And you've got both wireless intercept stations, Y stations, and code breaking operations in various places. So the British are operating in Colombo in Sri Lanka. There's a US and Australian operation in Melbourne in Australia. There's a US operation at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. There's another US Navy operation in Washington, D.C. And of course, there's Bletchley Park itself. So there's literally, they're strung around the world. And the first problem is, how do you communicate between them? And you can do that by wireless. But the second problem is, how do you keep that network secure? One of the problems was that the Americans, for their own communications, had their own cipher machines, and the British had its own cipher machines. The British have Typex. The Americans have a thing called CCM. And although these machines are similar, they're not the same. And neither country really wanted to give a load of its machines to the other.
That's what I was going to ask you about. You said there were various disagreements. How's this going to work? How they're going to cooperate with each other? Is that because, yeah, it's the sort of fear of giving away
exactly
hard work that they've taken a long time to develop in terms of intelligence?
It's partly that sort of professional jealousy about these are our skills, but also it's about technology as well, that the Americans are sending, you know, from the Y station to the code breakers, if it's been intercepted in Alaska somewhere and it's been sent to either Washington, D.C. or Pearl Harbor, that's been done with their own cipher machines. And they don't really want the British to have one of those cipher machines because they really still don't trust the British at this point.
And is that vice versa
yes,
as well?
Yes, absolutely vice versa. The solution they come up with is they create a joint cipher machine. Well, they say it's a joint cipher machine. Actually, there's a piece you can bolt onto a Typex machine, and it's the same piece that you can bolt onto the American machine, and it makes them talk to one another. And so they get around that problem. And then they have this wireless and cable network that links all these places up. And the idea is that now everyone can share everything with everybody else. The problem you have is, for the Americans, who are producing the lion's share of the material, once they've intercepted it and they've done the code breaking on it and they've shared it with their own people, they then have to re-encipher it in the shared code and send it to the British. And they kind of resent doing that. It's like, you know, it's an extra layer of effort. And also, the deal was that they would share intelligence about the Indian Ocean, where the Royal Navy is, where the British are particularly interested, obviously with Burma and operations out of India and everything else, versus the Pacific. The idea is that if the Americans get anything that's important to the British in the Indian Ocean, they'll pass it on. But often they don't bother, because their primary interest is in the battles in the, you know, the island chains of the Pacific and all the US Marine operation.
So how does Britain ensure it is getting as much as possible?
Well, they do a bit of their own interception from Colombo. They have Y stations in India and other places in that part of the world, which allow them to intercept some traffic directly. They also collaborate with the stations in Australia, and they just are constantly, you know, badgering the Americans, going, you know, tell us more stuff. By the end of the war, it works. And we're talking in this podcast about May 1945. And by that point, the system has, they've ironed out a lot of the kinks. The system is really starting to work. But what was interesting for me looking, because I went to the National Archives last week to look at some of the message traffic, and the archive in the UK is basically the material that was generated at Bletchley Park. And I know from some of the other literature about the messages that concerned the story we're talking about today, about the sinking of the Haguro. So I know there are messages that were produced, intercepts that were achieved, but they're not necessarily in the collection at Kew. But what there is in Kew is lots of other messages, or a few other messages, which are kind of subsidiary. There's messages where there'll be quite a trivial piece of information about some Japanese air reconnaissance, for example, where they've sent an aircraft out to search a particular bit of sea. But the reason they've done that is because they've got this Operation Shoe that we'll talk about is going on. And you see this quite mundane decrypt. There's a note at the bottom from the naval section saying, this refers to the operation, blah, 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 which is in message so-and-so. And the messages they refer to quite often have prefixes that show that they're messages that were broken in Washington, D.C. or messages that were broken in Australia. So Bletchley Park is still kind of picking up the scraps a little bit. They're not getting the really juicy messages. They're getting some of the other ones, but they are contributing to the story. And they do pick up some of the juicy messages as well, as we'll hear later on. So this particular battle of the Malacca Strait, is a sort of manifestation of where the US-UK-Australia SIGINT relationship has got to by the end of the war. And it's the product of 3 or 4 years of argument and technical innovation and hassle and more argument and, you know, people shuttling back to Washington, D.C. and discussing things. And what makes this important even today is that without all of this from 1942 to 1945, you wouldn't have got the famous Yukusa Agreement signed in 1946, which is the basis of Five Eyes, which is the SIGINT sharing relationship that continues to today. So this process and this relationship continued after the war and is one of the underpinnings of our security nowadays. That's where this fits into the sort of bigger picture. But also in terms of the wartime history of British code breaking in Bletchley Park, it's part of the story of Japanese code breaking both here and in Colombo at HMS Anderson, which was where the British code breaking was by that point. We covered this previously. They started out in Hong Kong in 1939. They thought Hong Kong was too dangerous. They moved to Singapore. Singapore got attacked by the Japanese, so they left Singapore and went to Colombo. They then got a bit worried about Colombo, so they went to Mombasa, to Kilindini in Mombasa in East Africa. And then when things cheered up a bit, they went back to Colombo again. So they're a bit of a movable feast. But by this point, they're back at HMS Anderson in Colombo. And HMS Anderson is getting bigger and bigger because as the war in Europe ended, a lot of people became available. And the Allies, the British and the Americans, were building up for what they assumed would be the land invasion of Japan, which was going to be a massive military operation, which in the end didn't happen because of the atomic bombs. But had it not been for the atomic bombs, there would have been a D-Day in Japan, which would have been absolutely epic. And you see from our Roll of Honour and from veteran testimony that a lot of staff who had spent most of their war in the UK start getting shipped out to the Far East and to Colombo and to Sri Lanka and other places, to Delhi, to build up this head of steam for the finishing of the final blows of the Japanese war, which don't ultimately happen.
So there really was a shift from attention in Europe to the Far East.
It's a shift of political and military focus. It's also a shift of personnel and a shift of equipment. And for the Royal Navy, it's a massive shift because once the war with Germany is over and the Italians have long gone, the home fleet that they've had to keep in Scapa Flow, which we've talked about previously in connection with these Arctic convoys and, you know, Bismarck and Tirpitz and all of that, all of those ships are suddenly free to go east. And the Royal Navy massively shifts its focus to the Indian Ocean and the Pacific in 1945, or particularly after May 1945.
World News Today, brought to you by shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country. CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts.
President Truman has fired the first shot in a new psychological warfare campaign against the Japanese. For details, CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
I found out this afternoon that the United States has thrown into high gear a dramatic psychological campaign against Japan. Our target is the Japanese leaders. Our purpose, to save lives and hasten the day of unconditional surrender. President Truman kicked off the campaign on VE Day. He read a statement to his news conference telling the Japanese just what to expect if they stayed in the war, and the terms for unconditional surrender. President Truman hammered one main point. The Japs have a choice: devastation of their country, or a surrender which does not mean enslavement or extermination.
You mentioned the cruiser Haguro. So tell us more about the Haguro.
Well, I could start by telling you what a cruiser is. It'd probably help.
Yes, please.
After World War One, you have an arms race between the key navies of the world, which is the UK, the USA, Japan, Italy, principally, also the French. And they want to regulate what ships people can build, because if it were an unfettered arms race, they'd all spend a huge amount of money on unnecessary numbers of ships. So they sign a treaty in Washington in the 1920s, and they sign a further treaty in London in 1930, which define what sorts of warships people are allowed to have, how big they should be, and how many you're allowed to have. One of the classes that's defined is heavy cruisers. You've got your battleships and your aircraft carriers, which are the biggest ones.
Okay.
The sort of next rung down is heavy cruisers, which are 10,000 tons displacement, which is HMS Belfast in London.
Yes, it's actually
a light cruiser, but it's a similar size ship.
Wow.
The guns on a heavy cruiser are slightly bigger. That's the sort of size of ship we're talking about. It's quite a big vessel. And all of the countries agreed that they would build these to a certain specification. In the 1920s, the Japanese build four cruisers to the same design, so-called Miyoko class. And what they do is that they take the letter of the law and they stretch it so that where the displacement, that the overall weight of the ship is defined by treaty as 10,000 tons. But it depends when you weigh it, basically. If you say, right, it's 10,000 tons with no fuel, with no crew, with no ammunition, with no whatever.
Okay, there's a loophole.
There's loopholes.
Yeah.
And that both they and the Germans are stretching the treaty definitions quite far. So you end up with four cruisers that are built in the late 20s, which are at the high end of probably the biggest of the heavy cruiser class. And they have 10 8-inch guns on them. They've got more guns on them, bigger guns on them than any other of similar ships in the world. So these are very powerful ships for their class. They then go on to fight in World War II, and there are four in the class. There's the Miyoko, after whom the class is named. There's the Nachi, There's the Haguro and there's the Ashigara. They all play a significant role in the various naval battles in the Pacific from 1941 through to 1945. Haguro is significantly involved in 1942 in the Battle of the Java Sea, which we don't really need to talk about. It just struck me as interesting that HMS Exeter, which is a very famous ship because it was involved in the sinking of the German battleship Graf Spee in the Battle of the River Plate, Exeter was famous because of that battle in 1939. Exeter, in turn, is sunk by the Haguro in the Java Sea in 1942. So the Royal Navy would have had it out for Haguro. By the time you get to 1945, only two of these ships are still at sea. The Miyoko was damaged in December 1944 by a US submarine. It basically blew the stern off the ship, but it was still afloat. They tied it to the dock in Singapore Harbour and used it as an anti-aircraft ship. Basically, it's just a static gun platform. The Natchi sunk again in late 1944 by US carrier aircraft. So those two ships are out of the picture. But by the time you get to May 1945, two are still around. These are the Haguro and the Ashigara. And they're both operating out of Singapore. 5th Cruiser Division is based in Singapore, and these two ships, along with accompanying destroyers and various other, what they call subchasers, which are sort of small corvette-sized ships, they have a little fleet going on based in Singapore. So that's where we are with Haguro and Ashigara by the time we get to 1945. So they're the last two remaining ships of this class, but they've got a bit of a history with the Royal Navy and, you know, they need to be got rid of. There's a big land campaign going on, which Tom has been talking about in the other podcasts in Burma. There's a land campaign with the British and Indian armies fighting the Japanese on land. And of course, the Americans are fighting an amphibious campaign with the US Marine Corps and the US Navy, sort of making their way across the various Pacific islands towards Japan. There's a whole series of famous US battles capturing these individual islands as they go along. There's more of a naval focus to it because the theatre of war consists of lots and lots of islands as opposed to being a sort of continental affair that
big
it is.
Mass, yeah.
Big landmass it is over here. So ships play a much bigger part. And particularly, although it doesn't get a lot of press, merchant shipping and convoys and trying to keep everybody supplied is a big part of the story because the Japanese have garrisons on all these islands. They have people in New Guinea. They have people up in Sakhalin near the Arctic and all the chains of islands in between. They have little garrisons of people and they have a huge fleet of merchant ships that are trying to get food and ammunition to everybody and new code books and whatever. And so a lot of the campaign is about breaking down those supply links. And this story about the Haguro is part of that in the sense that we're talking about the support of one of these Japanese island garrisons.
Prime Minister Suzuki once stated and then denied that the Battle of Okinawa was the decisive battle for Japan. At any rate, Jap defenses on the Ryukyu Island bastion have been shattered, with the enemy holding less than 8 square miles. That's 1/60th of the island's total surface. The end is not far off. It is a matter of opinion whether the current phase of the Pacific War may be termed Japan's post-Dunkirk or pre-Normandy period. But the indications are strong that the Damocles sword of invasion now hanging over the Japanese homeland will fall and strike in the not-too-distant future rather than remain a mere threat indefinitely. If and when our seaborne forces storm Japan's beaches, the island empire is likely to find itself in the position of Nazi Germany at the time of the Allied assault on the coast of France, despite the Churchillian phraseology which Prime Minister Suzuki used when he prevailed upon a surprisingly obstinate parliament to grant him dictatorial emergency powers.
What was Haguro up to in May 1945?
Well, this is where we come back to this supplying of island garrisons. And every day is a school day on the podcast, even for me. And I was researching this, and the places we're interested in are the Andaman and Nicobar Islands.
Okay.
And I'd heard of Nicobar. It's one of these sort of romantic kind of places you hear about in the 19th century. I actually had to look up where they are.
Okay,
and
I was just going to say, where are they, David?
People's geography of the Indian Ocean may not be great, but you have to imagine that on the right-hand side, on the eastern side of the Indian Ocean, you have India, what is now Bangladesh at the top,
yes.
And then you go into Burma, and Burma comes all the way down, and then it gets skinnier and skinnier until you get to Malaysia at the bottom, and then Singapore, finally.
Yeah.
You've got that coast there. At the bottom end, you have what is now Indonesia, you have Sumatra, so you have a big island off the Malaysian coast, and in between those is what's called the Straits of Malacca, where Malacca canes come from. Well, not from the straits, from the land next to the straits. And so that's the basic layout, but off the Burmese coast, up further north, or Myanmar as it's called now, you have these chains of small islands. And in the north are the Andaman Islands, and south of that are the Nicobar Islands. And these were nominally British Indian, because they're now part of, or the northern islands are part of India, and the southern islands are part of Burma. But for centuries, that didn't really matter because the indigenous Andamanese people are a distinct group of people. They're one of these isolated populations who nobody really had any contact with for years and years and years. And it was only in the 1850s or 1860s that anybody really had anything to do with them. Prior to that, if you turned up on their shore, they just killed you. They were quite territorial.
Fair enough.
And so by the 1850s, the Royal Navy's getting a bit annoyed about this, that if ships get wrecked and, you know, they want their people not to be killed. But also after the Indian Mutiny in 1857, they want a prison for political prisoners. So they create Port Blair on the Andaman Islands, which is basically a penal colony, has a massive prison and not much else. Little naval base, massive prison. And any troublemakers from India get sent to the prison there. But this has the terrible consequences that we're all familiar with from colonialism, that they introduce diseases that the Andamanese aren't immune to, and the Andamanese suffer quite badly just because their whole lifestyle is interrupted. But the islands are never really colonized beyond the prison. You've got sort of Port Blair in the prison, and then all the Andamanese carrying on living their lives. It's kind of a sad story because even now, the Indian government bans visitors to the islands because they want to preserve the lifestyle and
the culture.
The culture of the people who live there. It's only something like 500 original Andamanese left now. They're dying out. But certainly at this period, there was still a reasonable number of them. In 1942, the Japanese invade the islands because given that they're off the coast of Burma and there's a war going on in Burma, they are strategically important. If you can have ships or a naval base in the Andaman Islands, you are sort of just off Rangoon, capital Burma, major objective. So the Japanese send about 600 troops to the islands, and they don't really do anything. They don't get attacked at any point. They just live there. As far as I can tell, they spend most of their time being horrible to the Andamanese. They exploit them for slave labor because they don't have much food. They turn them into farmers on behalf of the Japanese, and they deport some of them. It's all rather unpleasant. But in 1945, the British and Indian Army is winning the war in Burma, and the Japanese government took the decision to abandon Rangoon without a fight. The British, they had an operation planning to capture Rangoon by force, but when they turned up, there were no Japanese there. They'd all left. And they're withdrawing back into southern Burma and then ultimately Malaya. This rendered the garrison in the Andaman Islands basically redundant. They're not serving any strategic purpose anymore. But the Japanese have a problem that they want to evacuate them, but they can't evacuate them all at the same time. So they need to keep them supplied with food and provisions while they manage an evacuation. They set up a thing called Operation SHU, S-H-O-O in English lettering. And this is an operation to send ships that will take food for the people that are staying there, but also bring off people gradually. And the Japanese Navy by this point has very few ships left, and merchant ships in particular have been absolutely massacred by Allied submarines. So finding ships that you can do this kind of operation with is quite difficult. And they're actually doing a lot of operations with what are referred to at the time as junks, which are these timber-built local merchant ships, and landing craft and all sorts of anything that floats, basically, they're using to move stuff around.
Okay.
And they come up with an operation where they're going to send the Haguro and an escorting destroyer and another merchant ship to the Andaman Islands, drop off some stuff, pick some people up and come back. And that's the plan. This brings us to the middle of May 1945. Haguro is about to set forth from Singapore to sail to the Andaman Islands to carry out this operation. And the question then is, what can the Allies do about that?
On the other side then, what did the British fleet in the Indian Ocean look like at this period?
I talked earlier about the idea that the Royal Navy in the East is massively reinforced, but it's not necessarily reinforced in the Indian Ocean. You have a political dimension with the United States. The US has been fighting this massive naval war, amphibious war in the Pacific for 3.5 years. And Admiral King, who was the US commander, his view was, we don't need the British. We're quite happy getting on with it. Let the British stay in the Indian Ocean and do their thing around India. We'll win in the Pacific. The British government and the Foreign Office have a different view. They go, we need to be involved in the war in the Pacific and the attack on Japan, because once peace comes, we need a big enough seat at the table. You know, we need to be shown to be part of this. If we let the Americans just defeat Japan on their own, the Pacific becomes an American lake. We're out of the picture. So they create the British Pacific Fleet, and this ends up being one of the largest Royal Naval deployments of the Second World War. They send 4 battleships, 6 of what they call fleet aircraft carriers, which are the biggest, most powerful aircraft carriers in the Royal Navy, another 15 smaller aircraft carriers, over 750 naval aircraft. So it's a really powerful set of ships, and lots of destroyers and escorts and everything else. But the Americans don't really want this fleet.
I was just going to ask, well, how do the Americans feel about that if they're like, no, we've got this?
That's basically their response. But the British go, no, we're going to be part of this. And they initially suggest that the Americans can help with the logistics because supplying all these ships is going to be very difficult. But the Americans are like, we're not sure about that. So they also have to send what they call a fleet train, which is merchant ships and Royal Navy fleet auxiliaries, which can supply the British fleet. And an even vaster number of support ships are sent.
There's a huge number.
It's hundreds of ships. And they base themselves in Sydney in Australia. And so their supply base is Sydney. And they sort of operate out of Sydney. They do shore bombardments and aircraft carrier aeroplane strikes in support of some of the US land operations. And they're making attacks on the Japanese home islands as well. So the Royal Navy is involved, but the US Navy tends to keep them at arm's length from the Japanese Navy. They don't get involved in sort of the final naval battles of the war in the Pacific. But that fleet then, after 1945, goes on to be a major British presence in the Pacific. And we sort of get our foot in the water around there post-war as a consequence. It's very important politically, although not essential strategically. But what this means for what had been called the Eastern Fleet, which is the fleet based in the Indian Ocean, based in Sri Lanka, this is the navy that Britain has had out there since before the war, originally based in Singapore. Initially, in late 1944, they're going, great, lots and lots of ships are coming now. You know, we're getting reinforced. I mean, this is an oversimplification, but those ships basically sail by and go to the Pacific.
Okay.
And all of the newer and better ships that had previously been in the Indian Ocean get taken away
oh.
and sent to the Pacific.
Okay.
So while the British Pacific fleet gets nice and big, the fleet that's left in the Indian Ocean dealing with Burma and whatever else is going on gets smaller and gets older. The East Indies fleet, as it's rechristened, is left with one battleship, the Queen Elizabeth, which is a First World War vintage battleship. It's pretty old. The battlecruiser Renown, again, is pretty old. Some cruisers, a few small aircraft carriers and escorts, destroyers and submarines and things. It's a much diminished force from what it had been earlier in the war. But its main function now is to police the Indian Ocean and make sure that the Japanese can't do exactly the type of thing we're talking about, which is reinforce their troops in Burma or regather their garrisons from various islands or interfere with anything that's going on in the Indian Ocean.
The fact that they've left so few ships in the Indian Ocean, is that just a realignment of their priorities and wanting to have a sort of hand in what was going on in the Pacific? Or did they just think it was very unlikely that the Japanese would be making manoeuvres in the Indian Ocean?
It's a bit of both. The focus is on the Pacific, but it's also been noted that the Japanese don't have the capability or the interest in doing very much in the Indian Ocean. And there are sort of mutterings in the East Indies fleet that they're launching aircraft from aircraft carriers to go and destroy like one or two ships, you know, one crappy little merchant ship making its way up the Sumatran coast. They all descend on it because it's all they've got. Targets are a bit scarce, shall we say. When they hear that Operation Shu might be happening and that there might be a Japanese heavy cruiser kicking around, then obviously everyone gets off their chairs at that point because this is a big deal.
News from the Navy, which for security reasons is a somewhat rare event, now includes pictures of the launching of HMS Indefatigable. This picture of the ceremony has only just been released, as also the later picture of the great aircraft carrier at Portsmouth when she was inspected by the King. With the Queen and the Princesses, he went aboard at a Scottish port to wish the ship's company good hunting and good luck in the new sphere of operations to which this already famous battleship was about to sail. Just as the royal family wished them luck at their inspection last October, so now, today, Britain wishes good fortune and victorious action to all who sail against the Japs. In spite of losses, the Japanese Navy is still a powerful force. But already, Britain has sent heavy reinforcements to Allied naval strength in the East. More will follow.
How then do the Allies find out about the Japanese operation?
Well, this is where the code breaking comes in. But I have to bring in the reservations I mentioned earlier that it's not necessarily Bletchley Park code breaking or even British code breaking. The Japanese are using a code called JN25, which is their main naval fleet code. It's being broken in Washington, D.C., it's been broken in London, it's been broken in Colombo, and it's been broken in Australia. So there are intercepts being picked up and messages being broken and then shared around in different places. So it's probably an American intercept that reveals that this operation is happening. It crops up in a number of different messages intercepted in different places. And it's a good example of the sort of aggregation and fusion process you have to do with signals intelligence. That there's no one message that says, tomorrow we, the Japanese Navy, are going to do X. But in all sorts of different places, they've picked up hints about air reconnaissance flights or references to the ships or references to the Andaman Islands or whatever. And this Brusa circuit is now sufficiently efficient that these pieces are being fitted together and it all works. The example that I can give you, which I found in the National Archives the other day, this is a message from Naval Section on the 9th of May, 1945. And it says at the top, JN11 FB6. JN11 is the Japanese merchant ship code. And it lists a number of people that this message has been sent to and from. And I can read you the message. It says, until the completion of SHU, which is the name of the operation, until the completion of SHU drills, request that enemy intelligence in the outlying islands area be reported without fail to commanders Cruiser Division 5 and Air Group 936. It doesn't mention what the operation is about. It just says, this is going on. Please tell us anything you think is important. But there's a note at the bottom. It says 4J comment. And 4J is Naval Section 4J, and J is for Japanese. This operation is the transport of troops from the Andamans and Nicobars to Singapore in Ashigara with Kamikaze and number one Kuroshio with SG-57. They know exactly what's going on because they've read other messages about it. And this is just yet another piece of the puzzle going, oh, yeah, here's another reference to SHU. But what's interesting about it is it says the operation is the transport of troops in Ashigara and Kamikaze. Kamikaze is a destroyer, which was indeed there. Ashigara is the other heavy cruiser, right, not Haguro. Yes. So they know it's a Nachi-class heavy cruiser, but they've got the wrong one. It doesn't really matter because both ships are more or less the same. But obviously the Japanese have been using enciphered call signs or codes to describe their individual ships. And the intelligence is good enough to know that it refers to a heavy cruiser of this class, but they haven't worked out exactly which ship
one.
It is.
Got you.
And most of the battle is fought thinking they're fighting the Ashigara. Well, in fact, they're not. They're fighting the Haguro. And it shows one of the shortcomings of this code-breaking. The other thing that's interesting about these messages is with Enigma or Lorenz, once you've got the key, you get the whole message because it's letter-by-letter encryption. JN25 and JN11 work on what's called a numerical additive, where each word in the message is represented by a number, and then you add another number to it. What that means is you have to build up the codebook gradually word by word, and the codebooks are never complete. So quite often, and I was reading this in Q, you go through the message and it'll say such and such and such blank, such and such blank. You can see that code groups, they don't have the solution for.
The information for.
And so quite often the messages are partial in a way that they're not with letter by letter ciphers. And you have to use a lot more kind of inference and backfilling. And in other cases, because each code breaking group are building up their own code book, that they share solutions with each other, but sometimes their books are different. So you'll get a decryption from one place with blanks in it, and you'll get a decryption from another place of the same message with different blanks in it. And then by comparing the two, they can then kind of cancel each other out and improve each other's knowledge of the codebook. And this is why the circuit is important, is the fact that these groups that are working independently can now intercommunicate and help each other as well as helping the intelligence.
The British receiving station at Flowerdown, in spite of the distance halfway around the globe, was able to record a certain amount of Japanese traffic. And that was great, but it was less than a fifth of the total available. The large quantities of traffic recorded either on the American West Coast or even in the American Pacific Islands came to us in paper form by diplomatic bag about twice a week, but two or three weeks late. And that was, of course, a huge handicap which we were never able to overcome. At one point, I remember, we said to Washington very politely, would you like to cable us the raw material, and then we could get it hugely sooner, to which, and I'm sure they were entirely justified in this, they said no. So we were stuck with this situation on the supply of raw material. Now, it's obvious that where there were chunks of this material that could be fairly easily solved, Washington would themselves have solved it long before the raw material ever reached us. Cable was used to exchange recovered, solved additives. So we didn't waste our time starting on what we knew they had already solved. What we couldn't foresee, and this sometimes did lead to disappointment and frustration, was that we might have what we considered a very good day and recovered a lot of additives and sent them off happily to Washington, saying, in effect, look what we've got, only to find that the following day, their cabling, their recoveries to us would include what we had just found and a lot more besides. And you couldn't help being disappointed by that. But, we swallowed it and carried on.
The consequence of all of this back and forth with messages is that on the 10th of May, the Allies know that a Natchez-class cruiser is going to head off from Singapore up through the Straits of Malacca and up to the Andaman Islands. Arriving there on the 12th of May, then it will stay there overnight, and then before dawn the following morning, it will sail back again. And then on the 11th of May, they see more information about air operations from the Andaman Islands themselves, where they've got seaplanes. These are going to fly around and patrol and make sure that the Royal Navy isn't anywhere nearby. So they've got a pretty good idea that the operation is going to happen. Skipping ahead a bit, we then discover on the 12th of May that these Japanese aircraft have indeed seen the Royal Navy, because an operation is launched, which I'll talk about in a minute. And so the Japanese realise that they've been rumbled, and Haguro, not Ashigara, actually turns around and goes back to Singapore again.
Okay.
So the first time the Japanese mount the operation, they give up halfway through. They go, no, it's not secret anymore. We've been rumbled. So they go back. But significantly, on the 14th of May, they start again, and the codebreakers pick up that Haguro or Ashigara has left Singapore for the second time and is this time heading off.
Do we know what gave the Japanese the confidence to just start again? If they've been rumbled once, you know, it's almost an instantaneous turnaround.
It is pretty much. They've left it a couple of days, but I think their air reconnaissance may not have found any more Royal Navy ships. They will have seen a few ships, and then they go out the next day and those ships aren't there anymore. They go, well, maybe the British have gone away again. Maybe they were there only coincidentally. They were doing a routine sweep or something. They weren't necessarily looking for us. And obviously, when you send a group of ships out like this, particularly destroyers, they don't have that much fuel. So if you're there for a couple of days, you'll probably go away again. You can't just linger about indefinitely.
Just keep circling.
The other thing that puts the Japanese off is when they set out the first time, the Allies know, because in the Malacca Strait, they have a number of British submarines running a sort of submarine picket. They're basically, because it's a narrow strip of water, they can sit in there and anything that comes along, they'll see. The problem is it's also a very shallow bit of water. So it's a crazy place to try and operate a submarine, because in places the water is barely deep enough. And if you get attacked by an enemy ship in your submarine, you're in a lot of trouble. First time Haguro goes out, she is spotted by a British submarine, and the submarine commander actually attacks Haguro with some torpedoes, but he gets his maths wrong and he misses, and Haguro sort of sails off. But the Japanese know they've been attacked, and the British know that they're there. I mean, the Japanese at that point go, no, we're going home again. And the British go, right, there was definitely a heavy cruiser. We saw it. That's the signals intelligence picture.
Shall we pick up the story then from this second attempt? The 14th of May, the Japanese send out the Haguro again. What happens from that point onwards?
We need to dole back a little bit to when it sails the first time, after it's been spotted by the submarines, the East Indies fleet set up what they call Operation Dukedom. And they create Task Force 61, which is basically all the ships they've got. There's the battleship Queen Elizabeth. There's a French cruiser called the Richelieu, because the French Navy, since the defeat of the Germans, has been freed up to operate again, because prior to that, the French Navy's basically been in harbour, supervised by the Germans. So the French battleship Richelieu, there's four aircraft carriers, cruiser Cumberland, and a Dutch ship, and lots of destroyers. They set off from Trincomalee in Sri Lanka and head towards the Burmese and Malaysian coast on the grounds that they want to find this heavy cruiser that's supposed to be floating around. And this is the force that the Japanese air reconnaissance aircraft see. And they go, oh, there's two battleships coming. We best go. And that's when they return to Singapore. The British fleet remains in the area and they fly off their own air reconnaissance aircraft from their aircraft carriers. But these escort carriers are called the leader class, meaning people who are in charge of stuff. They're called the Khedive, the Emperor and the Shah. All kinds of interesting names for heads of state. So the Japanese have been scared off the first time, but then Haguro comes out again with kamikaze the second time. And this time HMS Shah, one of these aircraft carriers, flies off aircraft and they spot the Japanese ship. They attack it with bombs, but they don't manage to hit it. One of the pilots thinks he has hit it, but he hasn't. The British have very little history of dive bombing. It's not something that Fleet Air Arm has done very much of. But they now know the ship's there. So what the Royal Navy decide to do is to send the 26th Destroyer Flotilla, who are these, they're small escort ships, send these five destroyers racing ahead, because HMS Queen Elizabeth is quite old, it's quite slow. The carriers are pretty slow. They get the fastest ships, which is the destroyers. So you go ahead and you find this heavy cruiser. They're led by a chap who later becomes an admiral. At the time, he's what they call a Captain D. The Captain D is a person, he's not the captain of a ship, he's the commander of a flotilla of ships. So he's got these five ships under his command. They race ahead to try and find Haguro. This is a bit of a challenge because destroyers of that sort up against a heavy cruiser, it would be a pretty stiff fight, particularly if you attack in daylight. The advantage the destroyers have is they want to get in close and fire torpedoes. But the Haguro has these 8-inch guns on it, which shoot vastly further than any of the guns on the destroyers. So if they approached in daylight, the Haguro would be able to shoot at the destroyers for some time before they get anywhere near close enough to do any damage. So it's not really a wise idea. Manly Power, who's the chap in charge.
I'm so sorry. It sounded like you said Manly Power.
Yes, his name is Manly Power.
Great name.
Captain Manly Power and his flotilla. His plan is that they think once again that Haguro has turned around in its racing back to Singapore. If you imagine the Burmese and Malayan coast on your right-hand side, heading from sort of northwest to southeast, Haguro is heading down that coast, and the bottom half of that journey is the Malacca Strait, is in between Sumatra and the mainland. So Power's plan is to try and get between Haguro and Singapore and sort of block it off. But he wants to do that at night because he knows that his ship's all equipped with radar. The Japanese have radar, but it's not as good. And if they fight at night, they've got a much better chance of getting in close and doing what they need to do. But his idea is that if they can spread out in such a way that they can come in from all points of the compass, the Japanese will have to decide which way to shoot. I mean, it's just much easier. So what he does is he arranges his ships in a sort of arc with the sort of the tips of the crescent in the north and the bottom of the crescent in the south, semicircular arc. And they go in towards the Malacca Strait, and then they sail south, but very slowly, at 12 knots. And their hope is that the Haguro will come into the arc, and they've set a trap, and they then just close around the back of it, and they've got it completely encircled. And indeed, this is what they do. They get a radar contact fairly early on. The radar operator is an interesting guy because there's a lot of storms going on, and these tropical storms create radar echoes. And so there's a lot of stuff going on the radar that's just weather. And this radar operator goes, yeah, I've seen a lot of weather, but there's this thing that I don't think is weather. I think it's a ship. And everyone's going, no, it's far too far away. It can't be a ship. The radar doesn't reach that far. But he goes, no, I think it is a ship. And he has to argue his case for quite a long time. But eventually other ships start picking up the same blip and they go, oh, yeah, oh, it is a ship. And sure enough, Haguro sails into their trap. And sometime after midnight, the British ships, their plan is to sail gradually south until Haguro has come far enough into their arc. And then they'll all suddenly turn back and sail north again and envelop it. They're just about to turn back north when clearly the Haguro's radar operator has woken up and realized that he's got all these ships surrounding him, because Haguro and Kamikaze, the destroyer that's with it, suddenly turn around and go back north themselves. At which point Power's going, all right, the chase is on now, because we haven't quite closed the trap, but they're there.
In our grasp.
Everybody knows everybody else is there. And then a rather chaotic battle breaks out, because it's all very well surprising the enemy by all coming in from different directions. But in the dark, with two enemy ships and five British ships, the British ships don't really know, you know, if you see a ship in the distance, is it one of ours or is it one of theirs? And also there's the danger that if you're on one side of the enemy and you fire your torpedoes and one of your friendly ships is on the other side of the enemy, the torpedoes can go through and hit your own ships. There is one point where one of the Aztec, the sonar operators on one of the destroyers, has his headphones on, and he says he hears what is the unmistakable sound of two torpedoes passing either side of his ship. When they plot it all out afterwards, they go, those torpedoes had to have been British. Because Haguro, they've actually taken the torpedoes off Haguro and filled that space of the ship up with fuel oil for the people in the Andaman Islands, which doesn't help when they start sinking. So yeah, it could have gone really pear-shaped, because once the battle starts, just chaos ensues. But actually, in the course of it, several of the British destroyers managed to fire torpedoes and hit Haguro, and Haguro eventually sinks, taking both the captain of the ship and the admiral of Cruiser Division 5 with it. The Japanese destroyer, their captain, there were questions at the time about Japanese naval doctrine, whether this is a very Japanese thing to do, but he realizes that when the Haguro, the cruiser, is being attacked by five enemy destroyers, him sailing around in another destroyer isn't going to help, because he'll just provide another target for the Haguro, because the Haguro won't be able to tell which his ship is which. So he just gets out of the way, and the Kamikaze actually sails off to Penang and skedaddles, and he's no longer part of the battle and survives. But what that means is Haguro is just surrounded and destroyed. In the course of it, although it fires its guns in all sorts of different directions, it only manages to hit the Somerez, which was Captain Power's ship. It hits it up once with one shell. And so the British casualties in the battle are literally two or three people. Well, it's not great if you're them, but it could have gone a lot worse. And so Haguro is sunk, and the British force sails away, more or less unscathed, having achieved a significant victory. I mean, it doesn't matter very much in the strategic picture of the war, because all Haguro was doing was going to the Andaman Islands to rescue a relatively insignificant garrison. But for a fleet who've been sitting around chasing wooden merchant ships for the last few months, it's a major coup. The Royal Navy see it as a great victory, and it's revenge for the Exeter and everything else. It's a big deal.
Is it a morale booster?
It's a definite morale booster. Although there are a number of personal accounts from people in the destroyer force, and more than one of them says they'd heard about VE Day. This is 2 weeks after VE Day. And one of them says, it would be a shame to be killed over here when our war is finished. Because he refers to the Pacific as the Yanks' War. Because they know that everyone at home is now going, well, it's peacetime. And they're going, well, we're still here. And, you know, we're off to fight this quite intimidating Japanese ship, which we're kind of going to win anyway. So they're all very relieved when they, you know, it gets sunk. There's a piece from one chap who was in the engine room of Somerez, and two of the engine room crew were the two people who were killed by the shell. And he said, everyone remembers it as this great victory. But he says, every Remembrance Day, he remembered those two guys. That was the war for him.
It's interesting to think about it from that perspective, because the focus up until that point, perhaps, and I'd ask you that question, is obviously victory in Europe, but then to still be continuing to fight, but not to have the awareness from maybe, you know, families at home or
this is
the media or the world at large.
You get a real definite sense of that at this point. That, and the same was for the soldiers in the army in Burma, that, you know, they're seeing in the newspapers, you know, VE Day, war's over. Like, no, it isn't. But equally for the Royal Navy, I mean, it makes big press in the UK because it shows that the war is still going on and that the Royal Navy is still doing good things. And we should mention that something like 750 men go down with the Haguro. The British weren't able to stay in the area to pick up anybody because the concern is enemy submarines or the kamikaze coming back or whatever. So they basically leave. The kamikaze is able to come back from Penang during the day, the following day, and does pick up something like 300 survivors who are still in the water at that point. But the British had also found that Japanese sailors are very reluctant to be picked up if their ship sinks.
Why is that?
It's part of the sort of Japanese code of not surrendering and everything. And there are accounts of where if they went to pick up survivors from a sunken Japanese ship, the Japanese in the water would actually swim away from the rescue ship. It gives you an indication of their sort of frame of mind. So that was the end of the Haguro.
You mentioned that the Japanese radar wasn't as good, perhaps, as the British. And the fact that it took the Haguro quite a long time to figure out it was getting surrounded. Do you know more about that? Why wasn't it as sophisticated as the British radar?
One of the questions about the operation, which was asked afterwards, was why does it take the Haguro so long to realise what's going on?
Yeah.
And one of the problems was, although 350 people survived, most of the officers went down with the ship. And so there were very few people left to say what was going on. But there is some testimony from Japanese side that suggests that their duty officers weren't very good. Their radar wasn't necessarily not working. They just weren't really paying enough attention. I think partly because they thought they were getting nearer to the Malacca Strait in Singapore, and they thought maybe that they were safer there than further north, whatever. But it remains a bit of a mystery why they didn't twig on earlier that they were about to be attacked. A postscript to this story in terms of the code breaking, of course, is that the crews on the destroyers are pretty sure that the ship has sunk, but the confirmation comes in Japanese message traffic. And there's a message that was intercepted by the US Navy subsequently on the 16th, probably from the destroyer Kamikaze. The call sign of the message was Horoni 2, number 2. These call signs, you're not sure. We were talking earlier, you don't know exactly which ship they necessarily refer to, but it's pretty sure that this was Kamikaze. And that described what had happened.
Action summary. At blank time, in position 04-49 north by 99-42 east, Haguro and Kamikaze on course 150. Speed, 22 knots. Encountered enemy task force made up of two cruisers and one destroyer heading southward. Engagement range was between 3 and 6 kilometers. At blank time, Haguro received a hit destroying blank gun blank. Damage incurred. Received 3 hits in 3 sections of the ship. 19 killed, 13 wounded.
I'm curious about the content of that message because it doesn't seem to match exactly as you described. Is that just the benefit of 80 years of hindsight and we know exactly what's happened? Is this very typical of sort of initial first messages coming through? This is what we think has happened.
It is, yes, exactly. Because if we think it's from the Japanese destroyer Kamikaze, Kamikaze had left the battle halfway through. So her captain doesn't really know what's happened either. But he's reporting what he thinks has happened. And when ships get attacked suddenly, almost always they signal that they're being attacked by a stronger force than they actually are. The Royal Navy are as bad at it as the German Navy or the Japanese Navy, whoever. And it says, enemy task force made up of 2 cruisers, and 1 destroyer. No, it was actually 5 destroyers. But they're like, you know, it must be big ships. So that's a common mistake for people to make, especially at night.
Yes.
You really don't know what's going on. And it says, Haguro received a hit destroying blank. We don't know quite what it destroyed. But when Kamikaze left, Haguro was still afloat. And the casualty figures are from the destroyer.
Gotcha.
So it's saying, yes, I was participant in a battle with an enemy force that might have been quite big, and then we left. And it's only days later that the information comes out.
So this traffic came from the Americans. What did the British know? What did they pick up?
Well, this is one of the things that's attractive about this story for us, is that a Bletchley Park person was involved. There's a chap called Norman Scott, who studied mathematics at Brasenose College, Oxford. He was 18 in 1939. He was allowed to go to Oxford for a year before being eligible for call-up. And so by the time he came eligible for call-up, Bletchley Park had found him and he was recruited as a codebreaker. And he worked in Japanese naval section. He worked on JN-11, which is the Japanese merchant ship code, but it works on the same additive system as JN-25, which we've been talking about. He became quite a skilled Japanese codebreaker. And then in late 1944, as we were talking about, there's this build-up in the East, and he's sent to Colombo, and he gets to Colombo in January 1945. When he gets there, he switches to working on JN-25, which is this main fleet code that we've been talking about. And in his memoir, he's described his time at Bletchley and everything else. But what clearly was the, I suppose, the highlight of his war, which he concludes his memoir with, is the events of what he calls the end of May 1945.
Towards the end of May 1945, I had been on watch from 8 a.m. to noon and had returned for the 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. watch. The senior translator on duty came over with a very current but scantily readable message on JN-25. He explained to me that the Japanese were anxious to get a supply convoy from Singapore to the garrison and airfield in the Andaman Islands. It was known that a Japanese cruiser of the Haguro class was involved in this relief operation. The message was expected to lay out the plans, so I buckled down to work. Including the new message, I recollect a depth of 3 or 4 on the mostly unsolved worksheet. The translator alternatively phoned HQ's intelligence section with more scraps of the message, and then suggested words which I could try in the still unsolved columns. At 8 p.m, the relief translators came on watch, but no cryptanalyst. Apparently there was a big party going on in the mess. I can remember taking a few minutes break in the canteen at the station for a mug of tea and a sandwich. Then it was back to the grind and slug from 2 a.m. to 8 a.m. The designated cryptanalyst on duty was myself. However, we now began to make significant progress. By about 5 a.m, the intelligence people were no longer calling every 10 minutes. I drank more tea in the comparative cool of the pre-dawn hours. Until the evening of that day, no noisy party in the mess could have disturbed my sleep, after being on watch for 20 of the previous 24 hours. Some 3 or 4 days later, the local press printed a naval communique, which gave the news that a flotilla of British destroyers had sunk a Japanese cruiser in the Indian Ocean. Not long after, a DSO was awarded to the flotilla commander, and a DSC to one of the destroyer commanders.
How then were these events recorded at Bletchley Park?
Well, this is the other aspect of this story which drew me into it originally. When we were creating the Intelligence Factory exhibition downstairs, I did a lot of work on naval section. And one of the parts of naval section that we feature in the exhibition is the naval indexes. And this is where all of the intelligence information that was gathered was written onto index cards and stored, so that this was the sort of how you found out what was going on. And one of the indexes that we have in our collection, one of the objects that we have on loan from GCHQ, is the Japanese ships index. There's two Japanese ships index. There's the Japanese ships index and there's the Japanese ships sunk index. And basically what happens is the cards stay in the one box until the ship sinks and then it gets moved to the other box. And this index has cards for all 4 of the Natchi class cruisers. We actually have these index cards on display downstairs in the exhibition, and we created an interactive activity around them where you can use the cards to find out information about the ships. And what is particularly striking about these cards is each card is, as you can imagine, it's a 6x4 index card with sort of lines on it. In the top left-hand corner, you have Haguro, and then it says cruiser, 8-inch, tells you what the ship is. And then underneath are a series of dates, and against each date is a piece of information about what that ship is doing. And each of those dates refers to a message that's been intercepted. But if you look at the top of the page, you'll see the entries on the card are in different colours. We've got red entries, blue entries, and black entries, and underlined entries. And if you look closely, you'll see that red, it says British Y. So that's messages intercepted by the British. You've got NID4. You've got American, which is messages derived from the USA. You've also got sightings, which is actually where the ship's physically been seen by aircraft or other ships. Black is what's mysteriously described as Z, but Z is British codebreaking, is ultra, basically.
Ah, got it.
It's referred to as Z traffic. And then underneath, as I say, you have all these little snippets about what Haguro has been doing. And you can read on the card, the last entry for Haguro on the penultimate card is 18th of April, for example. And it says, at 10:50 on 18th of April, attacked by submarine at, and then it gives the latitude, longitude position, will arrive in Commercial Harbour, Singapore on 20th of April. On the final card are a whole series of messages relating to Haguro, which have been copied onto the card later. And it says in the first entry for 14th of May, now known to be Haguro and not Ashigara in Force 1. So if you look at the Ashigara card, there's all these messages which don't actually relate to the Ashigara, they relate to the Haguro, because they couldn't tell the two ships apart. But once they've worked out that the Haguro has been sunk, they go back and they update the cards to correct the message traffic. So it's quite a nice little thing. And you can see the final entry on the right-hand side of that card is sunk off Penang, NID, which is Naval Intelligence Division, and then there's a reference number for the message.
I would say there's a couple of different handwritings here.
Oh, yes. I mean, you'll have different people on watch in the index. Almost all exclusively would have been women, possibly Wrens, and every ship in the Japanese Navy would have had one of these cards, and their job every day is to keep updated where these ships are, what they're doing. I mean, if one of these messages about Operation Shu had come in, the watch officer in naval section would have trotted along to the index and gone, can you show me the Haguro card? What's going on? And they would have looked and you'd have seen, oh, it was last seen on 20th of April in Singapore. So what's it doing now? You know, or if they got the message would pass to the index so it could be added to the system. And this really shows how the intelligence process, not just the code breaking, but the intelligence analysis process works at Bletchley, is they have literally millions of these cards with all of the information they've captured being updated and updated and updated. But it also shows that the system isn't completely foolproof because they've muddled two ships up.
Yes.
They sorted out when the Haguro is sunk. And then subsequently, the Ashigara is sunk as well.
Okay.
In September, I think it is. Ultimately, all four Natchi-class cruisers end up in the Japanese ships sunk index by the end of the war.
I'm fascinated as well by, you said, ultra traffic is marked on these cards as Z. So even within Bletchley Park, there's a sort of layer of secrecy there of not writing Bletchley Park or something of Z.
Well, it's just shorthand. We use ultra as a sort of catch-all term to describe high-level intelligence from Bletchley Park. Actually, it has various meanings according to who's using it. Naval section almost exclusively refer to Z traffic, which means high-level communications by the Germans or the Japanese or whatever.
Right.
And the message numbers are prefixed by Z. Or you get ZTP, which is Z teleprint or whatever. So, but if you'd walked in here, if someone said to you Z traffic, everyone would know what you're talking about. It's just one of the varying shorthands that they have. Also, they have a system where the number of Zs on the message reflected its importance or urgency. So you get between 1 and 4 Zs typed on the message to indicate.
You really got to pay attention to this one.
You really got to pay attention. And that's probably why it became known as Z traffic, because it had 1 or more Zs on it.
Okay. How is it that these cards have survived? How have we got these in our collection?
GCHQ, at the end of the war, they had histories written of all the different sections, but also they kept what you call a dip sample of paperwork of different kinds, because they were worried that they'd have to do the whole thing again if there was another war, and they wanted to remember how they did it. They kept samples of different processes, and as a result of that, they kept a number of card indexes. They couldn't keep all the card indexes because it would have filled a warehouse, but they took examples of different ones. And then those documents have been transferred by GCHQ to our archive here, although they still belong to Cheltenham. And so we have a varied assortment of indexes of different things. But it happens that one of the ones that's been kept is the Japanese ships index and the Japanese ships sunk index. We also have the Italian ship index. They're fascinating documents because they do show the granular detail of the operation about basically every ship in the Japanese Navy, as far as they can, is being followed. Or every time it crops up in a message, it's being recorded. And this is being supported by wall plots as well. You've got maps with pins in showing what you, and it's an insight into the process. And having the cards, as you say, with the different people's handwriting on, really brings to life the process. And
the people behind.
And the people. And you can imagine the people in the index. This is their day-to-day grind, you know, or night-to-night if they're on shift. And, you know, you go, oh, it's gone to Singapore, or it's gone to Japan. There must have been a satisfaction for whoever it was who sat down and wrote, sunk off Penang.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.